Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Take your pick, money or less red tape. Choices to make in the opioid crisis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 26th of October, Wednesday by my calendar. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Actually, it's Thursday by my calendar. Today, it turns out, was the day. For months, President Trump has said he was about to declare the opioid crisis a national emergency. An event at the White House this afternoon, he signed a declaration of public health emergency after giving the requisite set of remarks, of which this was the relevant passage.
I am directing all executive agencies to use every appropriate emergency authority to fight the opioid crisis.
The declaration the president signed doesn't come with any new money. What it does, as he said, is cut out some red tape to help more people get treatment, and it lets states use federal money they've already got for this crisis. Marketplace's Amy Scott has some of the details.
Dr. Rahul Gupta has seen the toll of the opioid crisis up close. He's commissioner of public health for the state of West Virginia, where more people die of drug overdoses than anywhere in the country. Gupta welcomed today's emergency declaration for raising awareness and cutting red tape, but without additional funding.
Just improving the efficiency, unfortunately, will not be able to help us address this particular crisis.
Typically, an emergency declaration opens up a response fund of up to $30 million, but that fund has been depleted almost entirely by the fight against outbreaks like Zika. Health economics professor Richard Frank at Harvard says replenishing the fund would take an act of Congress.
So it's not like you get access to this big new pot of money. In fact, the design of that program is really aimed at a public health emergency, not something that's been in the making since 1979.
The federal government is already targeting billions of dollars through Medicaid and a grant program to help states expand access to treatment. Cynthia Riley with the Pew Charitable Trust says states have only received part of that funding.
The good news is that this announcement would seem to indicate that that funding will indeed be distributed to the states as expected.
The emergency declaration also allows states to shift other federal funding, like a Labor Department grant for displaced workers. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Up the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue today at the Capitol, House Republicans passed their budget plan this afternoon. It was close, 216 to 212, but the vote wasn't really about the budget per se. What it is going to do is let the GOP pass its tax plan with just a simple majority in the Senate, which, as you know, has been the sticking point for Republican legislation. The other thing that is going to happen as a result of today's vote is that the House is going to release the text of its tax bill next Wednesday. There will be, as you can guess, much back and forth on this thing in the next month or so. The current target is to have it passed by Thanksgiving. The relevant equation here, just as a refresher, is closing enough loopholes and getting rid of enough deductions to cut taxes enough so that the deficit doesn't rise by more than $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. That is to say, deficit-financed tax cuts. Elsewhere in Washington, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, told a congressional hearing yesterday some changes are coming to a media industry that is itself changing. Pai said he's going to have the commission vote next month on a proposal to roll back rules governing how many media outlets a single company can own in a single local market. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's going on here.
Right now, you can't own a newspaper and a TV or radio station in the same local market. And you're usually not allowed to own more than one major news outlet in a market. The idea back in 1975 was to promote local news and prevent media monopolies.
The marketplace today is nothing like it was in 1975.
FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai telling Congress why he wants to lift and relax those rules.
Well, we're thrilled.
Danielle Coffey is with the News Media Alliance, representing 2,000 media outlets. She says if the same company can own newspapers and broadcast stations, that'll bring more investment to local outlets that are struggling. As for fears of reduced competition,
there are countless sources of news and information today, so I don't think anybody with a straight face would argue that competition for news and information is a problem.
Maybe not for news writ large, but within local news, competition and diversity are real issues, says Marty Kaplan, professor at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
The number of people who consume local television news and say it's their number one source of news is wildly larger than the number of people who get original content news from online sources.
Matthew Hale teaches at Seton Hall University. He says there are concrete examples of consolidation in local news.
And you have Sinclair Broadcasting, which is trying to buy Tribune, and they're going to reach 7 out of 10 Americans. That's a pretty centralized news source, and it's a pretty conservative news source.
The FCC will vote on relaxing the rules on November 16th. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaking of ownership, there was late mergers and acquisitions news today. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that CVS, the pharmacy, is in talks to buy the insurance giant Aetna for $66 billion. You can go ahead and insert appropriate caveats here about regulatory review and antitrust issues. On Wall Street this Thursday, a little bouncy, mostly up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Chinese President Xi Jinping, as you might have heard, was installed for another entirely expected 5-year term by the Communist Party Congress in Beijing this week. And in the course of a 3-plus-hour speech to open that Congress, Xi said something that hasn't gotten a whole lot of notice here but is all over the Chinese press. He wants, Xi said, to build a moderately prosperous society. That's the quote, moderately prosperous. Bearing in mind that China is now the second biggest economy in the world, and as such, its fortunes are our fortunes, we've called our China correspondent, Jennifer Pak, to help understand what is going on. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Kai.
So this phrase, moderately prosperous, that I mentioned, that is not, it doesn't sound like a resounding endorsement of the Chinese economy.
Oh, well, actually, it may very well be. It's been almost 4 decades since China started opening its economy to the outside world. Some of that growth has been happening as what people described as breakneck speed. Right. You've heard of double-digit growth. Roughly, what that means is you have people who knew what it was like to be hungry to now their kids eating so much that obesity is a problem. So now China's economy is slowing down. And if this happens too fast, the gap between the rich and the poor will only get bigger and bigger. So this year, President Xi Jinping did not mention a GDP growth target in his speech. And now the Chinese media is buzzing about this term moderately prosperous society. The focus on this magical GDP figure to keep the Chinese people happy has put so much pressure on officials that economists believe that there's a temptation to inflate the numbers.
Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, the Chinese were not the only ones obsessing about the Chinese growth statistics, right? I mean, we did in this country as well, a whole bunch. If I'm an American company or a foreign company looking to do business in China, what do you think this means for me?
Well, for American businesses, for a long time, they were based in China producing cheap goods to sell back to the American public or to Europe. Now, the economy needs to flip it around. So Chinese consumers need to buy some of that products, not only from foreign companies, but also from their own companies to power the growth. And there's a hope that the president will allow this process to happen, which could get messy. And it could mean people will lose their jobs. For example, economists say that unproductive state-owned companies need to fail. And in the immediate term, foreign businesses just want to know whether the internet will work. Because right now, connecting to the outside world has become so frustrating. There's no indication whether these restrictions will ease up at all. And what this means is that simple task that you do here in the U.S., like calling your company headquarters on Skype or sending large files, can take hours to resolve in China.
Let me go sideways a little bit here and ask you what you make of the fact, just on businesses wanting to know what the future holds. What do you make of the fact that Xi Jinping came out the other day without a clear successor, that he is now in charge with sort of an indeterminate future?
Well, a lot of people have thought that the past 5 years have been pretty much about President Xi Jinping consolidating his power, yeah. Right? So that meant that the necessary reforms that he announced 5 years ago didn't always go according to plan. So the truth is that nobody really knows what is going on right now. Even though these events are highly staged, you see these men in their black uniforms stoically clapping along. They are supposed to appear unified. But really what's happening is that there's a lot of friction between the leaders at all times. So it's very hard to be certain about anything in China. Anyone who tells you differently, well, you have to watch out.
Jennifer Peck is our brand new Shanghai correspondent. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We had Janice Min on the program the other day talking about the Harvey Weinstein scandal. Min used to run The Hollywood Reporter, and she pointed out how so many people knew what was going on, and yet they did nothing. The same thing has happened in the other cases that have become public in the 10 days since the Weinstein story broke. People just standing by instead of doing something when they see something going on that's not okay. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has a lesson from Psychology 101 now on the bystander effect and its relevance for businesses today.
Kitty Genovese was brutally murdered in New York, 1964. The New York Times ran a front-page article with this shocking first line.
For more than a half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew Gardens.
That attack became a symbol of collective apathy, of people looking the other way instead of helping out. In 1994, President Bill Clinton, at a public safety speech, recounted Kitty's murder.
A call to the police would have brought a patrol car in 2 minutes. But as one man told investigators, I don't want to get involved.
The details of some of those original reports, the number of bystanders, their response, and lack of response have been called into question. But Kitty's death opened up an area of research by psychologists that's just as relevant today, known as the bystander effect.
When we see problematic things that are happening, we often take the role of bystander. We don't intervene.
Dr. Keltner is a psychology professor at UC Berkeley. He says multiple studies out there show that when a group of people sees something bad happening, individuals are less likely to help out. Part of the explanation is what psychologists call diffusion of responsibility.
We assume other people intervene, and then we pull back from our more nobler tendencies.
There's something else. If I see nobody acting, I think that maybe I'm misunderstanding what's going on. And I sit on my hands, which brings us to the Harvey Weinstein allegations. The open secret of his alleged harassment wasn't just shared in hushed whispers over drinks at the Beverly Hills Hotel Polo Lounge. Weinstein's aggressions were written into the TV show 30 Rock.
I'm not afraid of anyone in show business. I turned down intercourse with Harvey Weinstein on no less than 3 occasions out of 5.
Seth MacFarlane joked about Weinstein, announcing the nominees for the Oscars 2013 Best Supporting Actress category.
Congratulations, you five ladies no longer have to pretend to be attracted to Harvey Weinstein.
That joking, laughing.
You're normalizing it. You're saying it's okay. You're complicit.
Stephanie Johnson is a professor at the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Everyone knew this was going on, but because no one would say anything and everyone knows everyone else knows, you shouldn't say anything. So it's just the bystander effect at play.
Harassment isn't isolated to Hollywood and the media. According to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, almost a third of the 90,000 workplace charges they received in 2015 involved harassment. So how do you take the insight about the bystander effect and apply it? Johnson says one answer is bystander intervention training. basically teaching bystanders to do something.
Part of the problem with the bystander effect is you don't know if you should step in, but you also don't know how to step in.
Last year, the EEOC released a study of workplace harassment and recommended employers add bystander intervention training. Paula Arrowsmith-Jones is with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team, which is a nonprofit in California that does office training on harassment prevention. She says the bystander piece is still a pretty new idea.
I haven't really had employers asking specifically for bystander intervention training.
But she says her team has started incorporating it. They teach strategies like creating a distraction.
I might go up and interrupt what's happening without naming it specifically, but more like making an excuse to get the person in danger away from the person who's causing the harm.
Jones says feeling empowered to step in.
It's rarely about knowing the perfect solution or the perfect words. It's more about being willing to see it as a shared responsibility.
A sense of responsibility that could help stop serial harassers. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And we sort of treated it like it. We treat every other Broadway show.
Except every other Broadway show, it most certainly is not. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 71 today, about 0.3%, closed at 23,400. NASDAQ down 7 points, about 0.1%, 65.56. The S&P 500 up 0.3%, 25.60 there. As we told you, the head of the FCC is planning to loosen the rules surrounding who can own what when it comes to newspapers, television, and radio stations in single markets. Sabree mentioned the Sinclair Tribune deal. Sinclair Group up 0.1% today. Tribune Media almost also rose almost 0.5%. Been a long time coming today. Twitter posted strong earnings and said, oh, by the by, it might turn its first profit ever next quarter. That sent the share price into the 140-character stratosphere, up 18.5%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note, up to 2.46%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment. The automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Extreme weather, the hurricanes and the rains and the wildfires have cost taxpayers more than $350 billion in the past decade. That's from a Government Accountability Office report, which goes on to say that those costs could double by the middle of the century. Meanwhile, President Trump's current budget proposal includes cuts to FEMA. And remember, he tweeted this month that FEMA is not going to be in Puerto Rico forever. All of which is to say that the towns and cities and states hit by recent disasters and those most at risk for future problems have plenty of cause to be nervous about the costs of rebuilding. Investors, it turns out, have reason to be nervous as well. S&P and Moody's have new reports out on the risks of federal disaster aid drying up while the costs of damages from those disasters continue to rise. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath reports.
Eric Glass manages billions of dollars for the investment firm AllianceBernstein. He says he's glad the ratings agencies are starting to consider climate risk in their municipal bond portfolios, but
I think it's duh that they should have been doing this already.
Glass says he's got $37 billion invested in muni bonds alone, and that he's used climate risk in his calculations for years.
Climate change will have a direct impact on the tax bases of municipalities. And I'm not going to invest in any municipality or municipal entity without them articulating a very solid resiliency plan.
Whether it's increased flooding in the south or drought and fires in the west, Glass says, climate change can turn towns and cities into riskier investments. A city funding its own rebuilding after a hurricane, say, might have a hard time paying back its bond debt at the same time. He says it's his duty to protect clients from that. Rob Fernandez is at Breckenridge Capital Investments. He says if a community does get a credit downgrade,
it's going to cost the community more to expand that school district, you know, build a new high school, build a new water treatment plant. It's going to cost more, and the community's residents are going to have to pay more.
And he adds, if a city wants to borrow money to protect itself from climate change, building higher levees or seawalls, for example, that'll cost more, too. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Here's one of those good-to-have problems if you're running a business. Your product is crazy popular, so popular that word of mouth is basically the only advertising you need. People are willing to pay top dollar, and demand 2 years after you launched is still through the roof. Of course, with such success comes a desire to scale to maximize your reach, which in turn presents its own challenges. That is the enviable dilemma the producers of Hamilton find themselves in. They've got shows going in New York, Chicago, and L.A., and are starting rehearsals in London. Jason Bazett is the production supervisor for Hamilton, all of them. It's his job to make sure everything is ready when the curtains go up. He's been with the show since the beginning, so when I talked to him, I asked him what he knows now that he wishes he knew back then.
Well, when we started on Broadway, we didn't staff up enough. Because ultimately what we realized is that Hamilton is an incredibly physically demanding show. And we sort of treated it like you treat every other Broadway show, which is you have a certain amount of offstage people that cover the onstage people.
Covering, you mean like understudy for
like
and
understudies,
stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly. What we call, some people we call swings because they go on for the ensemble, and other people we call covers or understudies that go on for principals. And we had probably six people offstage. And what we realized is that because the show is so physically demanding that the onstage people, they are more inclined to get hurt or exhausted or be out. So now we have like 12 people offstage.
Yeah. I have to tell you, when I saw it a couple of weeks ago here in L.A., I was blown away by how dynamic it was on stage. I mean, there's a lot of moving around and jumping and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, the ensemble never leaves the stage, really. Yeah. I mean, they have a problem, you know, finding a place to go to the bathroom in the middle of the show if they have to.
I hadn't thought of that, but yeah. You also use something called universal actors, is that right? Tell me about that and how that works.
Yeah, we call them universal swings.
Swings.
The swings are like an ensemble person who is offstage. Like a male swing will learn six different ensemble tracks on stage. Yeah, exactly. It's not easy.
Because there's so much motion. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is a little crazy. It takes a unique person to be a swing, incredibly organized person to be a swing. What we also found is that as we opened a couple of extra shows, what we thought would be a good thing to have in our back pocket would be to have someone who could travel to any show at any given time. And that becomes an even more specialized sort of swing in that there are tiny nuanced differences between the New York show to the Chicago show to the LA show. And a universal swing basically has to know what those differences are.
And is it a thing where they'll get a call on a Tuesday afternoon and say, you need to be in Chicago by curtain time tomorrow?
Yeah. Wow. We had a circumstance where, we had somebody get injured, somebody was on vacation, and somebody else was out for whatever reason in Los Angeles. And we called an actor, I think it was at 10 o'clock on a Friday night to say, well, I called the actor to say, how do you feel about having an adventure this weekend? And this actor was so amazing that she just said, well, that's the job, isn't it? And I said, that's exactly right. It is the job. We're, get some sleep. We're sending a car for you at 4 o'clock this morning so you can be ready for a matinee in L.A. if you need to be.
This is a bigger picture question and not probably even remotely in your control, but is there a finite number of productions of this thing that you can see around the globe eventually?
That is a good question. I don't know what that is. It's funny. I was just sitting at dinner with an incredible producer the other night, Cameron McIntosh, who did Les Mis, and he did a lot of, of course, you know who he is. But I at one point turned to him and it said, at the height of Les Mis, how many productions did you have out?
Yeah.
And he said 16.
Wow, that seems like a lot.
It's a remarkable, it was a record at that moment. But he then turned to me and said, I think Hamilton will have more.
Wow. Your job would be a nightmare.
Well,
you think?
Depends on how you look at it, I guess.
Well, yeah.
I can't complain. I love my job.
Jason Bassett, he is the production supervisor for Hamilton. Jason, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, Electoral Aftermath Division. Twitter says it's not going to sell advertising to the Russian media outlets RT and Sputnik anymore amid accusations that the social media company didn't do enough during last year's campaign to fend off international meddling. Twitter said it's going to take the $2 million or so it's gotten from RT since 2011 and use it to, quote, support external research into the use of Twitter in civic engagement and elections, end of quote. RT pointed out in response to today's decision that Twitter had done a whole sales pitch a year and a half ago to get more of its ad dollars on during the campaign. So, you know, that. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 71 today, about 0.3%. NASDAQ down 0.7%. S&P 500 up 3 points, about 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.